Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. State lawmakers don't appear ready to take up recommendations to reform education funding in the first state.
There's really no coherent leadership in Dover to push these recommendations forward. And that means that the school funding reform effort is very likely to stall until after the elections in November.
Contributor Larry Nangest examines the path ahead for education funding reform in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about bee population concerns and how to help these pollinators thrive locally. Arts Playlist takes us to a Delaware native's new exhibit at the Biggs Museum of American Art. And History Matters explores some of the state's lost history. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In December, an independent assessment of Delaware's public education funding system was released, recommending substantial changes. The American Institutes for Research Studies suggests what Delaware spends on education is not enough based on student outcomes, and recommends the state significantly increase spending while distributing more resources according to student need and implementing a weighted student funding formula. Lawmakers received a briefing on the report earlier this month, and based on the reaction, it appears there's no rush to implement the recommendations the report offered. This week, contributor Larry Nangest examines reaction to the report and what the path forward could be in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to walk us through what he learned.
First, let's just recap what the key recommendations of the American Institutes for Research study were, specifically when it comes to how much the state spends on education.
Well, the piece of the report that has gotten the most attention is the recommendation that the state increase annual education spending by somewhere between $500 million and $1.1 billion. And that would ensure that all public school students receive an adequate education. And it would also, they would recommend changing to a weighted school funding system that would allocate more dollars to schools with greater numbers of low-income and special needs students and English learners than to schools with lower concentrations of these students. Other important recommendations include giving school districts more flexibility in how they use their funds and increasing transparency in how funding and spending are reported.
So lawmakers did receive a briefing on the report earlier this month at a Joint Education Committee hearing. And one thing your story notes is that there was a presentation by a University of Delaware professor who helped prepare the report, comparing Delaware with other states when it comes to education funding. What did that presentation show?
Well, actually, Professor Ken Shores wasn't involved in preparing the report, but he was invited to participate in the hearing, perhaps to offer a little bit more Delaware context here. And he did add a couple of very fresh insights to the discussion. First of all, he pointed out that from 1987 to 2008, there were 38 other states that implemented significant reforms to their school funding systems. So the underlying message that he's giving here is quite clear. If all these other states can fix their school funding problems, Delaware can too. The second point he made is that compared with other states, our school property tax rates are really, really low.
So I think it's fair to say that lawmakers' reaction to the report and that presentation this month were at best lukewarm. What did you hear from lawmakers about what they're thinking about this report? Is it fair to say that there's not likely to be immediate action on this?
Well, back in December, you know, the consensus then seemed to be that the most action we would get this spring on school funding reform would be taking some small steps forward, maybe something like creating a task force or a special committee to examine how to actually implement these reforms. Right now, it doesn't even look like we're going to get that far. Senator Laura Sturgeon, who's chairman of the Senate Education Committee, and she's a retired teacher as well, says that there's no agreement at all among her colleagues on the House and Senate Education Committees. Indeed, at that joint committee hearing 3 weeks ago, we heard everything across the board. That we were hearing that the money that we spend now isn't going to where it's needed most. And then there were others who were saying, why should we spend more money if the payoff that we're getting now isn't very good? Now, on top of that, Governor John Carney has not endorsed the report's recommendations. He, in fact, said very little, if anything, about it. So there's really no coherent leadership in Dover to push these recommendations forward. And that means that the school reform, funding reform effort is very likely to stall until after the elections in November.
And with that in mind, if nothing happens this year, that means any action will come under a new governor next year. So what do we know about where the candidates running to replace John Carney stand on this issue?
Okay, we can summarize that pretty quickly. Let's start with the three contenders for the Democratic Party's nomination. A couple of weeks ago, you asked Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long about the report in a recent interview, and her response discussed equity issues, education equity issues, and a need to adjust funding formulas, but she stopped short of endorsing the recommendations in the report. I spoke to Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer, and he called the current school funding in Delaware drastically inadequate, and he said that he would implement these recommendations, quote, with urgency, unquote. The third Democratic contender, former Natural Resources Secretary Colin Amara, has pledged on his campaign website to enact the report's recommendations. Reached out to the only announced Republican candidate, Jerry Price, and he did not respond to an emailed request for comment.
So the big hurdle to implementing the study's recommendations clearly is the price tag. And that is something few appear to really want to address head on. So what can you tell us about what's being said about the amount this study is talking about, the willingness to spend that kind of money or something close to it? And if there is any kind of willingness, where could the state possibly find that much money?
Okay, a couple of things here. First of all, that $500 million to $1.1 billion that's talked about in the report is a huge sum. And this is an election year, so no one wants to talk about raising taxes. And of course, that's where most, if not all, of the new money is going to have to come from. Now, considering what other states have done, there are a lot of other places to look for as revenue sources. Other states have raised sales taxes, but Delaware is proud to be one of the few states in the nation that have no sales tax, so that's probably a no-starter. Some states have implemented statewide property taxes. With reassessments now underway in all three counties, that might be easier to implement in a couple of years, but nobody's really talking about that right now. Now, there's likely to be some talk about changing laws concerning local school taxes, maybe giving local school boards the power to approve relatively small increases, like 2 or 3% a year, without going to referendum. That's not necessarily a big way of raising money, but it's certainly something to talk about here. One of the Democratic candidates for governor, Matt Meyer, did mention raising tax rates on high-income individuals. But now, that's not necessarily a school funding gambit. Raising taxes on the wealthy is an idea that we hear just about every year, and that's just in a matter of increasing state revenues rather than being specifically directed towards schools. Raising corporate taxes and fees is another possibility, but nobody's talking about that yet at all. So the bottom line here, school funding reform is a complex issue, and figuring out where the funds will come from is just as complex.
So let's assume for a moment there is a bigger pot of money to spend. What else do those in the education realm feel needs to happen to make sure that if the state spends that money, it gets a return on its investment?
Well, yeah, what you're talking about here is flexibility. Now, with the state's current unit funding system, which was created in the 1940s, about 90% of the state's education dollars are allocated for specific purposes. And this means that school districts and school leaders are limited in how they can actually use most of the money that's in their budgets. Now, so if you give the school leaders more flexibility, if you let them use the money where they feel that it's needed most, the argument goes, then you will see better results. However, One of the problems that we've seen in the past, and we're seeing it in Dover now, is that legislators are saying we shouldn't give the schools more funds because we've been giving them more money for several years and the test scores are still low. What we've really seen, though, here is that what we're doing now is not working. And if it's not working, we should try something different. Now, whether that requires spending $1 billion more or maybe only $500 million more, that remains to be seen. But the formula that the state is using now is not producing the results that our leaders want and that our students deserve.
So it may be a matter of mixing both more money spent and changing the way you spend that money. As we discussed when the report first came out in December, Larry, there are those who are not interested in being patient, although it looks like this is going to require some. Could the threat of more legal action, because legal action is what started us down this road, could more legal action force some movement if lawmakers tend to drag their feet?
Yes, it certainly could. The Delaware chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, which provided legal support to the plaintiffs who filed the lawsuit that led to the preparation of the school funding report, said in December that if the General Assembly didn't act on school funding reform fairly quickly, that this report would become Exhibit A in a new lawsuit. Now, the ACLU, when I spoke to them the other day, says that warning still stands, but it hasn't set a deadline for the state to take action. My best guess here is that the ACLU is going to be ready to act sometime in 2025 if the new governor and the new General Assembly don't start taking significant steps by next June of 2025.
So obviously what is probably necessary in some way, shape, or form is some kind of leadership on this issue. Is there a sense from the people you talk to that someone or some group is likely to emerge to lead some version of education funding reform based on this report?
Well, I hate to say this, but my answer is no. Right now, there's no parent group, there's no advocacy organization, no one that has a broad base of support that's in a position to take the lead on this issue. Now, there are leaders in the business and nonprofit communities who support education reform, but they haven't succeeded or tried hard enough to secure reforms in the last 20 years. So I'm really not sure how much faith we can all put in them. There are a few individuals in the General Assembly who give me hope, and it's possible that the next governor will turn words into action and make funding reform actually an urgent priority. But right now, I just don't see the pieces coming together.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. His piece on what's next for state education funding reform is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at the health of bee populations and what you should know if you want to help these pollinators thrive locally. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A swarm of environmental threats are driving down bee populations worldwide. In response, honeybees and their keepers in North America became the face of Save the Bees. But apiarists in Delaware are sounding the alarm on the ongoing threat to native bee populations. Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki explores the buzz about bees with first aid experts and advocates, and what Delawareans can do to help certain bee species take flight.
It's the first time state apiarist Emily Wine has been out to check on her honeybee colonies this spring. She zips up her bee suit, making sure there are no small openings for the bees to creep into, and stuffs some newspaper and kindling into her bee smoker.
Basically, the smoke calms them down and keeps them from stinging you.
Wine started beekeeping in college more than 10 years ago, originally studying environmental science and then going on to get her master's in entomology. Now she spends most of her days helping beekeepers inspect their colonies and educating wannabe keepers. Today, Wine is looking for varroa mites, the most damaging pest for honeybees. She scoops out half a cup of bees, around 300 of them, and dumps them in an alcohol wash. She shakes it and looks for the mites that settle at the bottom.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm counting. That means I'm going to have to treat this spring because treatment threshold in the spring is 1%.
Honeybees are not among the 4,000 plus bee species native to North America, like bumblebees or carpenter bees. And as foreigners, honeybees have also adapted to feed on other non-native species, thus pollinating them and potentially contributing to invasive plant growth. And when a hive is infested with varroa mites, its residents can also carry viruses, risking spillover into native bee populations.
It's important to keep your honeybee colonies healthy and make sure that they do have low levels of pathogens and viruses so that they're not really spreading that in the landscape, whether that's to other honeybees or to native bees.
The Save the Bee movement exploded in the early 2000s, responding to increasing concern about declining bee populations. Wine estimates the number of beekeepers in the state have gone up by about 200, from 301 to 512 since 2006, noting Delaware bee law requires that all apiaries be registered annually to maintain accurate records of the number of beekeepers and bee colonies in Delaware, but many often fall behind. It also helps wine to respond effectively to disease outbreaks. And now, given the current state of the agriculture industry, Wine says the native bee population isn't big enough to support all crop pollination.
For producing honey, for producing wax, for doing pollination, honeybees are critical for agriculture in a way that our native bees aren't able to fulfill with the way our current agricultural system is. So we need them for agriculture. And they're great for small business and the economy and being able to produce those hive products.
While honeybees offer a helping hand at times, the reality is...
I would say there is a real bee crisis, but it's a native bee crisis. It's not a honeybee crisis.
That's backed up by the Delaware Wildlife Action Plan, created by DenRec's Division of Fish and Wildlife. It notes flower-visiting insects account for 50% of all known insect extinctions, and 11 of Delaware's more than 250 species of bees and wasps were identified as species of greatest conservation need. But a few simple additions to a garden or even a front doorstep can help and will likely attract native bees over honeybees. Native bees are more solitary, nesting in the ground or other cavities, and are not able to optimize their foraging decisions the way honeybees do, like a democracy, making collective decisions to forage on the most abundant nectar sources and will travel as far as 3 to 5 miles to find them.
If you've got this little patch of land by your house, you may not be able to plant enough to really attract a whole bunch of honeybees, but you could provide a good habitat for some native bees that are foraging just in that small range.
Even so, Wine concedes that with a hive mentality and beekeepers to coddle them, honeybees are not going anywhere anytime soon.
This is a nice hive. Oh, that's pretty. Look at that. This is just really pretty.
Sussex Vice President of the Delaware Beekeepers Association, Jim Hopkins, loves his honeybees. This year, he'll be managing more bee colonies than ever before, more than 60, which at its peak could amount to more than 3 million honeybees. This is the first time Hopkins has cracked his hives open since the fall, and from the looks of it, they've been busier than, well, you know.
See all the larvae in here? This is a pretty strong hive. I could split this today.
The queen has been busy making babies, and it's time to split the hive to make room for more. But Hopkins isn't just raising healthy honeybee hives to fight off mites. While Wine treats any colonies with a 1% varroa mite concentration, Hopkins has 2 thriving colonies with mite thresholds upwards of 13%.
You see this hive here? That one and this one with a tag were part of a USDA survey last year. I did not treat them last year. Emily tested them. We were at 0 mites the 1st of May. 2nd of October, we were at 13.7%. 3% is a lot. 13.7%.
Yeah, that's, I mean, at that point, the hive's done, right?
Bees are coming out of it. I just split one of them.
Oh, so they are?
Yes.
Oh, so they had all these mites. There was a 13.7%, but...
There's something about those bees that allowed them to overcome 13.7% infestation. That's the genetic testing I'm doing.
Hopkins says that something is a grooming behavior that honeybees naturally developed in response to varroa mites, and that the USDA is now trying to breed into honeybee populations as fast as possible.
Aloe grooming or auto. Auto is themselves, aloe is the others. It's like you see a pride of monkeys picking lice. They're doing the same type behavior. It's a grooming behavior, and it's a genetic add-on behavior.
Hopkins says when it comes to honeybees, the pros and cons of how they affect native bees is more of a wash.
And I think that we need to treat them all as pollinators instead of different species of bees, because they're all subject to the same environmental hazards, whether it's temperature or humidity or drought or what we have here is dearth. We hit July and there's nothing for them to eat.
He says today's bee populations need more grasses and flowering plants, not only to feed on, but to hide in and reproduce. And he has an idea of where to plant.
Just what we've done to ditches and median strips is enough to feed them all.
Yeah,
save the gas, save the emissions, let it grow. Make it beautiful. Be proud of it.
No,
we're a small state. We can do these things. The worst they could do is take a strip of Kirkwood Highway and turn it into a flower patch. Where's the downside?
Mount Cuba Center Public Programs Coordinator Leah Brooks argues that native bees are essential to a diverse ecosystem and in many ways are better pollinators than honeybees. Honeybees are great for pollinating certain monoculture crops, but they can't perform buzz pollination like many native bees can, which is essential to increase yield of crops like blueberries, tomatoes, and peppers. She adds native bees are just messier pollinators, and that increases the chances of pollination as they travel from plant to plant.
So if we just had honeybees, our native ecosystems would be suffering for it. And in some cases, we have the honeybees outcompeting the native bees in those ecosystems. And since they're not pollinating the native plants the same way that the native bees are, or they're preventing the native bees from adequately pollinating them, you can run into issues.
Brooks says many of North America's native bees are in decline due to habitat loss, degradation, and fragmentation.
Natural habitats like grasslands and forests, they're chock full of native vegetation. Those are being replaced at a rapid rate by roadways, monocultured lawns, crops, and non-native gardens. And when this happens, the natural resources that the native bees need for nesting, overwintering, and foraging are destroyed, or they're changed in such a drastic way that the bees can't adapt and persist to survive in that area.
And in areas where those sorts of resources are already limited, beekeeping can actually exacerbate the problem.
Raising honeybees to save the bees is like raising chickens to save the birds. Native bee populations are declining, and I don't see a reversal in near future unless everybody got on board and we as a society understood which issues those native bees are facing and how we can fix them. So for people who say to themselves, I want to help, so I'm going to look into getting a hive, I would say reconsider and instead think about, I want to help pollinators. Let me see how I can help native bees. And their first step is, if they have a space to do it in, would be planting native flowers.
For the amateur or expert gardener, Brooks suggests limiting herbicide and insecticide use to targeted applications instead of non-selective broad-spectrum sprays. Best case scenario, eliminate it altogether and adopt an approach known as integrated pest management, combining multiple methods such as attracting natural predators to the garden or pulling weeds by hand. And for those who don't have the yard or space for planting, Brooks says they can still be an advocate for native bees and help change the narrative that bees are scary or threatening.
They don't have a hive to protect. They aren't protecting their resources, their brood. They are just doing their own thing. So I find that that is often helpful for people to know. If you're scared of bees, and it's usually from a run-in with a honeybee, that the native bees are usually more relaxed.
And as demonstrated by Wine and Hopkins, honeybees aren't much interested in interacting with people either.
Look at us. We're standing right in the midst of, what did we say, 200,000 bees or so, and we're fine.
But we should be interested in them, Wine says, namely their well-being, because the world's food supply depends on it. Rachel Sawicki, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Rachel. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a preview of a Delaware native's new horse-centric exhibit at the Biggs Museum of American Art. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. First State native Rebecca Raubacher fell in love with horses when she was a young girl after her older sister took her to a farm and put her on a pony. When Raubacher returned home, she asked for a pencil and paper so she could draw the animals she had just seen. That love of art and horses is now on display in Raubacher's latest exhibition, Rebecca Raubacher, Horses and Other Creatures, at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover, on view until July 7th. For this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Engel is joined by Raubacher to discuss her work and this exhibition, Horses and Other Creatures.
When you were a young girl, your older sister took you to a farm, put you on a pony, and when you got home, you asked for a pencil and paper and transferred that moment so that you kept it with you. Tell us a little bit more about that moment. That's very inspirational.
My youthful postcard, so to speak. It was just magical to me. My sister loved horses and she would spend time and talk to me about horses, and I would ask her many questions. I was only 3 and a half. And so she had this chance to take me to a farm, and I fell in love with everything. I fell in love with the ponies and the horses and the aroma of the farm. I loved walking into the barn, smelling the hay, hearing the straw getting pushed around in stalls, the soft knicker, everything, the entire experience just hooked me immediately. And I was a horse crazy little girl and became a horse crazy adult.
Were farms and were horses before that moment in your memory? And I know 3 and a half, what do you remember? But were they accessible to you in the sense that you could get to a farm relatively quickly? Or were you kind of amplifying that need to capture that because you had to keep it with you?
That's where the drawing came in. You know, if I was pining to be out to see a horse or to be near a pony, you know, I would sit down with my paper and pencil. But, you know, I'm a little bit older. And in my neighborhood growing up in North Wilmington, the city sidewalk ended at my front yard. And we had a man that came around with a horse and cart called Bob the Ragman. And my mom would say, well, you know, Bob the Ragman's coming today. And I would sit on that front porch and wait for that beautiful big draft horse. I could hear it clopping way far away. It was everything about them, their sounds, their breathing, everything about them.
There's a statement you've made about if you could draw something as a child, you could somehow kind of own it, possess it, feel a little closer to it. But then that you feel like that's changed now a little bit. Tell us about that transference.
A little bit of it is that they now own me. You know, I'll have an image that's haunting me in my mind, or I'll see something and it's a memory. It owns me because I now look at my drawings and I can often even know what the weather was like that day. You know, it brings me back. It's not just that I own it. It owns me and it owns all my memories of that time.
You do something called fluid line. Tell me a little bit about that. I love this.
It comes from gesture drawing. I guess it's sort of a cross between gesture and quick contour. My hand is moving constantly, and I'm not always looking at the paper. And that, I guess, is where the fluidity comes from. Even on the large work, I will streak across, you know, 8 feet of paper or whatever, and the lines will make sense, and they'll tell me where the next line has to go. And it's rather exciting. I mean, I can do it with a pencil. I can do it with mechanical drawing pens or some of the, they have some wonderful pens you can buy in like Staples or whatever that have a great permanent ink and a very smooth, easy to make line. Or I've done large work where I have a fat charcoal in my hand, dip my hand in a bucket of water, and then make my line. So line is everything to me. When I was in art school and we were learning contour, I must have done 1,000 contours on my left hand because I was writing with my right hand just to study the line. And, you know, I guess I did my 10,000 and developed the skill. And there's no easy way. It's practice, practice, practice. And I never thought of it as a finished goal when I make a drawing. I always think of them as practice, which I think prevents me from bringing in the limitations of trying to create the perfect drawing or the perfect painting. Everything, even when I'm laying out an extremely large piece, it's practice. So my psyche doesn't interfere with trying to resolve the questions.
You work with some layers. Tell us a little bit about some of the other
layers. A lot
elements.
Of layers, yes. Yeah. And I use line. I often use oil stick, which is a very large oil crayon. It's the same as using oil paint. I can temper it with linseed oil or anything if I want. And I'll create my original line work for the composition. And then as I build it, I build many layers. I may do some acrylic. I may do more charcoal. I'll use oil stick or oil paint. And I will also work with, I do a method called resist, where I have put down oil stick and then I will go over it with watercolor. Now, I'm not mixing oil and water. I'm allowing the water to puddle and dry on the oil stick. And it will do the same thing on acrylic. And it creates a whole different layer and a whole nother tension. And then often I will apply a chalk pastel to finish off and give the subject some skin.
A small painting, a large painting, do they both take the same amount of time?
They can. And some paintings take years. Some paintings, I lay them out and I start to work on them and they are ahead of me. I haven't brought my intellect to the point where I can complete them, and I will set them aside and then I will pull them back out and look at them and finish them. A good example of that is the Two Bays and a Gray with Black Forms, the 13 and a half foot painting that's in the show. And that, I think I started in 91 and then just finished it before the show. I had pulled it out several times and said, no, that needs to go back. I haven't discovered what I have to do yet. So I never look at them as a fail. I look at them as information that I need to digest.
But there's got to be, okay, what goes in, what doesn't go in, what are the pieces that fit, don't fit? What were some of the challenges as you assembled this and thought about it coming together?
Well, my original big show was in 2019, and that was all figure work, except there was one little horse with blue that was in it, and many people came in and they asked, where's her horses? Because a lot of people knew me for my horses. So Michael Dudich, the previous director, had encouraged me to do a show about horses and other creatures. And it was interesting to, I always produce more work than I could possibly use. And believe it or not, we had to take work home. If you look at the show, it's over, I think it's almost 80 pieces. And we had to leave some at home because there wasn't room. But editing a show is very important. So I had backups in case I felt something would look better with something else. So we have the one small private little room, or more intimate room. So we put the mythology in there. But the big room, when you come in to see the show and you've got the big horses are right there to greet you, that to me was the power. And then, so you go through the big room with the big active horses, you pass the Greek mythology room, then you enter the African room, and I've got three very large giraffes in there. And then I was lucky enough that Laura had enjoyed my small work a lot and created the salon wall with all these other small drawings, which all of them take me back. Everyone I can look at and know what day it was and what we were doing and where we were, and was I on a boat? Was I cold? Was I hot? They all bring that back to me.
Thanks to Delaware artist Rebecca Raubacher and our Carl Engel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters and our conversation with the authors of a new book on Delaware's forgotten history. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Famed astronomer Carl Sagan once said, "You have to know the past to understand the present." But what if some of that past has been lost to the passage of time? In their new book, Lost Delaware, former First State journalists Rachel Kipp and Dan Shortridge shine a light on dozens of long-forgotten pieces of Delaware history that have been relegated to memories and lore until now. And in this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Kipp and Shortridge to talk about Lost Delaware and the parts of First State history that may not be getting their due.
Dan and Rachel, you both have released your new book, Lost Delaware, where you went in search of places in Delaware that have been mostly forgotten about and have faded at one point or another into history. Before we get into what you found, though, and how you found it, where did this idea exactly come from? And when did you both realize that you wanted to write a book like this, which is quite an undertaking, I might say, you know, but to write a book like this to shine a spotlight on key pieces of Delaware's history?
So we have written, this is our third book together. Our first one was a Delaware travel guide. So 100 things to do in Delaware before you die. And then after that, we wrote more of a history focused book called Secret Delaware, which was more about roadside attractions or kind of the stories behind sort of quirky things here in the First State. And so when we talked about what we wanted to do next, this kind of seemed almost like a little bit of a natural extension of that. We both really like history. We've both always been interested in that. And so it seemed like a natural fit to kind of delve into, you know, things that, after talking a lot about things that already are here or sort of things that you can sort of maybe see historical markers for here in Delaware, it seemed like a natural fit to talk about places and things that used to be part of the fabric of Delaware that are no longer around, but obviously are fondly remembered by, or maybe not so fondly remembered by, people who've been here a long time or have read the history, but to kind of open those stories up for people who maybe haven't, or remind people of them for those who have.
And regardless if you're a First State native or a Delaware newbie, it seems to me, as someone that is a Delaware newbie, that this is a book that not only everyone can get interested in, but feel like they have a real stake in this and in this kind of history in Delaware. Is that an accurate assessment? Am I on base with that?
I certainly think so and hope so. no matter whether you were born here or whether you've moved here or whether you grew up here, there are locations around this state that people remember and still refer back to. I grew up in Sussex County, and you know, you sometimes get driving directions by, you know, oh, go down the road and then hang a left at where the old general store used to be. You know, general store hasn't been there in ages, but that's how people still give directions. So what we really wanted to do was to focus on really keeping our history alive. And one great example is Wilmington Dry Goods. It was a store that really bound Wilmington together for decades, right up until its closure in the late 1970s. Now it's been decades yet since the dry was open, and it's gone into kind of that forgotten memory zone. Very few people walking around Wilmington today, living or working in the city, remember what it was like to shop there. So that's an important part of our mission here.
Well, as I said to start this, you went in search of places in Delaware that are essentially just distant memories and lore to most people today. You know, we're talking stores, restaurants, schools, institutions, and so on. Some that stuck out to me were Felton's Diamond State Drive-In, DuPont Motors, and the Stone Balloon Rock Club. But what were some that stick out to you as, you know, maybe some of your favorites or ones that most interested you?
One that really stuck with me because I grew up in Sussex County was Burton Brothers Hardware. That was just an old-fashioned hardware store in Seaford, right on High Street. It was a local landmark for decades. And it burned down in 2013. One of the brothers who owned it was also a local firefighter and drove one of the fire trucks to the scene to try to put out the fire at the store that he owned. A really kind of sad moment there. It couldn't be saved. But in the process of sorting through everything after the fire, they found some old documents and ledgers and things like that that somehow escaped the fire, that they then turned over to the Seaford Historical Society. So that was a nice happy ending would be the best way to put it there.
And Rachel, what about for you?
So you mentioned the Diamond Straight Drive-In. That was one that I had written up for the book, and it was really interesting for me to learn more about. I've been to the drive-in movie a couple times, not in Delaware, and always really enjoyed that experience. So it was interesting sort of looking at that, you know, that trend more broadly, but also how it caught on in Delaware. It was really interesting to read about the Diamond State Drive-In and just how they would. So they initially, their first sound system that they set up when they bought it in the early 1950s was actually bullhorns. And then later they added the in-car speakers that you'll see even today, I think, when you go to the drive-in. They also had a roller rink on the property for a while so they could try and get more patrons. They had live music shows there for a while, but they were just kind of done in by societal change in a way. So in the 50s and 60s, there were thousands of drive-ins in the US, but then as cars became more compact in the 60s and in the 70s and 80s, people didn't really want to sit in them watching a movie. There were always kind of logistical challenges to the drive-in because you can't really put on you can't show movies in bad weather. You can't really do it in the cold. In Delaware, you were actually not allowed to do so on Sundays because of blue laws. So the Diamond State struggled for several years and then ultimately closed for 10 years starting in 1985. Then a new owner or new someone who was leased the property tried to revive it in 1995, but it ultimately closed in the summer of 2008 because the property owners decided to sell the land. One detail I like from the book is that the last hurrah of the drive-in, when they showed the last movies there, people that were there to watch it, they offered a 200 horn salute with their cars between the two movies to kind of say goodbye to the drive-in.
These stories are fantastic. What a book this is. And looking at these places and these stories, Rachel, I think it's clear that there is this through line that binds these stories or these places and these stories together. But, you know, how'd you suss through and sort out what made the book and what didn't? Was there some sort of ranking system in an Excel spreadsheet here? Or was it just a lot of, you know, deliberation and collaboration, you know, between you both? What did that look like?
I mean, there was both a spreadsheet and deliberation and collaboration. So we started out, and we've done this with our other books too, because like, for example, our first one, we were limited to 100 things to do in Delaware. We obviously had a lot more than 100, and same thing with this book. I mean, we had a lot more. You could write 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 books about, you know, lost Delaware places and things. So we kind of started out with a big list and then started kind of culling it down into the items that ultimately made the book. And what we thought about, first of all, is obviously we wanted to span all of the state, you know, have items from Newcastle County, from Kent County, from Sussex County, and then also spanning the different areas. You know, we wanted to have things from agriculture, things from business, entertainment and sports, public life. It kind of coalesced into a chapter about mansions and old buildings because there are a lot of those here in Delaware. So we really wanted to make sure that we had diversity in all senses of the word in the book. And then also another factor was just, you know, being able to find out enough about that place or thing to be able to kind of construct a coherent narrative about it. And so we relied on lots of different sources for that. I mean, newspapers.com, where you can look up old issues of newspapers, was obviously a huge source. Books, we took a lot of books out of the library about Delaware history. The Delaware Historical Society had a treasure trove of photos that we used, but really trying to make sure that we could find enough about a place and enough verifiable information about a place that we were able to kind of tell a good story about it was also really important in figuring out what made the book.
That collaborative, obviously this isn't your first rodeo, as you've said, but the amount of research I imagine was immense to sort through, as you touched on there. But when it comes to this kind of undertaking, what did the timeline look like for this? And we'll pivot to you, Dan, here. What did the timeline look like for this? You know, did it take longer than you thought it would?
These things always do seem to take longer than you imagine them taking at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It took us about a year from start to finish. We kind of started slow at the beginning, coming up with the ideas, and then it's a matter of buckling down and just doing the research and then doing the writing. A couple times we were able to find, you know, the book or the article that had all the information we wanted in it. More often than not, though, it was piecing together pieces of information from here, there, and everywhere to kind of condense it into that story. One thing I do want to emphasize is that we could not have written this book if it weren't for the people who came before us, the historians and the journalists who a lot of times wrote about these things when they were happening. One of those was a guy named Bill Frank. He was a reporter and columnist with the News Journal newspapers. He died in 1989, but he wrote about so much over his time here in Delaware. I mean, for politics and business and culture. And quite a few times I was going back through the archives and found that exact piece that we needed with the precise information that we're looking for, and Bill Frank's byline was on top. So that was a nice reminder that journalists really do write the first draft of history.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in then what might have caught you off guard, while putting Lost Delaware together. What surprised you during this entire process and researching these places and people? Does anything stick out on that score?
The one that really hit it for me was the Delaplane, which was the name given to Delaware's first homegrown aircraft. And it was built by a typewriter company manager. He had built model planes before, but never built another plane, or never built a plane to carry humans. And that was in the early 1910s. It cost about $6,000, and they got it up in the air several times. It garnered a lot of local media coverage. People were just fascinated by this thing. But eventually, they had it stored in a barn, I think in the Hare's Corner area. Lightning struck the barn, and this thing is made of wood and cotton, and it just caught on fire and went up.
Thanks to authors Rachel Kipp and Dan Shortridge and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast on our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel and Rachel Sawicki, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.